day seemed without any logical coherence, and yet unbearably real. Thus, while the face of that unrecognizable being lighted up at the idea that the storm had passed, that she had understood his reasons, that she had accepted them, that he could finally talk to her about his big plans, she suddenly had the idea of stealing a knife from the table to stick in his throat when, in the room, he tried to deflower her. In the end, she didn't do it. Since in that restaurant, at that table, to her wine-fogged mind, her entire marriage, from the wedding dress to the ring, had turned out to make no sense, it also seemed to her that any possible sexual demand on Stefano's part would make no sense, above all to him. So at first she contemplated how to get the knife. She took the napkin off her lap, covered the knife with it, placed both back on her lap, prepared to drop the knife in her purse, and put the napkin back on the table. Then she gave it up. The screws holding together her new condition of wife, the restaurant, Amalfi, seemed to her so loose that at the end of dinner, Stefano's voice no longer reached her. In her ears, there was only a clamor of objects, living beings and thoughts, without definition. On the street, he started talking again about the good side of these saladas. They knew, he told her, important people in the city government. They had ties to the parties, the monarchists, the fascists. He liked to speak as if he really understood something about the Salata's dealings. He took a knowing tone. He said emphatically, "Politics is ugly, but it's important for making money." Lila remembered the discussions she had had with Pasquale in earlier times, and even the ones she'd had with Stefano during their engagement. The plan to separate themselves completely from their parents, from the abuses and hypocrisies and cruelties of the past. He said yes, she thought. He said he agreed. But he wasn't listening to me. Who did I talk to? I don't know this person. I don't know who he is. And yet, when he took her hand and whispered that he loved her, she didn't pull away. Maybe she planned to make him think that everything was in order, that they really were bride and groom on their honeymoon, in order to wound him more profoundly when she told him, with all the disgust she felt in her stomach, "To get into bed with the hotel porter, or with you, you both have smoke-yellowed fingers. It's the same revolting thing to me." Or maybe, and this I think is more likely, she was too frightened, and by now was striving to delay every reaction. As soon as they were in the room, he tried to kiss her, and she recoiled. Gravely, she opened the suitcase, took out her nightgown, gave her husband his pajamas. That attention made him smile happily at her, and he tried again to grab her. But she shut herself in the bathroom. Alone, she washed her face for a long time to get rid of the stupor from the wine, the impression of a world that had lost its contours. She didn't succeed. Rather, the feeling that her very gestures lacked coordination intensified. "What can I do?" she thought. "Stay locked in here all night?" And then, she was sorry that she hadn't taken the knife. For a moment, in fact, she believed that she had, then was forced to admit she hadn't. Sitting on the edge of the bathtub, she compared it appreciatively with the one in the new house, thinking that hers was nicer. Her towels, too, were of a higher quality. Hers? To whom, in fact, did the towels, the tub, everything belong? She was bothered by the idea that the ownership of the nice new things was guaranteed by the last name of that particular individual who was waiting for her out there. Karachi's possessions. She, too, was Karachi's possession. Stefano knocked on the door.
What are you doing? Do you feel all right?
She didn't answer. Her husband waited a little and knocked again. When nothing happened, he twisted the handle nervously and said in a tone of feigned amusement,
Do I have to break down the door?
Leela didn't doubt that he would have been capable of it. The stranger who waited for her outside was capable of anything. I too, she thought, am capable of anything. She undressed, she washed, she put on the nightgown, despising herself for the care with which she had chosen it months earlier. Stefano, purely a name that no longer coincided with the habits and affections of a few hours earlier, was sitting on the edge of the bed in his pajamas, and he jumped to his feet as soon as she appeared.
You took your time.
The time needed.
You look beautiful.
I'm very tired. I want to sleep.
We'll sleep later.
Now. You on your side, I on mine.
Okay. Come here.
I'm serious.
I am too.
Stefano uttered a little laugh, tried to take her by the hand. She drew back. He darkened.
What's wrong with you?
Leela hesitated. She sought the right expression, said softly, I don't want you. Stefano shook his head uncertainly, as if the three words were in a foreign language. He murmured that he had been waiting so long for that moment, day and night.
Please, he said in a pleading tone.
And, with an expression almost of dejection, he pointed to his wine-colored pajama pants and mumbled with a crooked smile,
See what happens to me just when I look at you?
She looked without wanting to and, with a spasm of disgust, averted her gaze. At that point, Stefano realized that she was about to lock herself in the bathroom again. And with an animal leap, he grabbed her by the waist, picked her up, and threw her on the bed. What was happening? It was clear that he didn't want to understand. He thought they had made peace at the restaurant. Now he was wondering, why is Leela behaving like this?
She's too young.
In fact, he was laughing, on top of her, trying to soothe her.
It's a beautiful thing,
he said.
You mustn't be afraid. I love you more than my mother and my sister.
But no, she was already pulling herself up to get away from him. How difficult it is to keep up with this girl. She says yes and means no. She says no and means yes. Stefano muttered,
No more of these whims.
And he stopped her again, sat astride her, pinned her wrists against the bedspread.
You said that we should wait, and we waited,
he said,
even though being near you without touching you was terrible and I suffered. But we're married now. Behave yourself, don't worry.
He leaned over to kiss her on the mouth, but she avoided him, turning her face forcefully to right and left, struggling, twisting, as she repeated, Leave me alone. I don't want you. I don't want you. I don't want you. At that point, almost against his will, the tone of Stefano's voice rose.
Now you're really pissing me off, Leela.
He repeated that remark two or three times, each time louder, as if to assimilate fully an order that was coming to him from very far away, perhaps even from before he was born. The order was,
Be a man, stay. Either you subdue her now, or you'll never subdue her. Your wife has to learn right away that she is the female and you're the male, and therefore she has to obey. And Leela, hearing him,
"You're pissing me off. You're pissing me off. You're pissing me off."
And seeing him, broad, heavy above her narrow pelvis, his sex erect, holding up the material of his pajamas like a tent support, remembered when, years before, he had wanted to grab her tongue with his fingers and prick it with a pin, because she had dared to humiliate Alfonso in a school competition. He was never Stefano, she seemed to discover suddenly. He was always the oldest son of Don Achille. And that thought immediately brought to the young face of her husband, like a revival, features that until that moment had remained prudently hidden in his blood, but that had always been there, waiting for their moment. Oh, yes. To please the neighborhood, to please her, Stefano had striven to be someone else, softening his features with courteousness, adapting his gaze to meekness, modeling his voice on the tones of conciliation. His fingers, his hands, his whole body had learned to restrain their force. But now the limits that he had imposed for so long were about to give way, and Leela was seized by a childish terror, greater than when we had to go down into the cellar to get our dolls. Don Achille was rising from the muck of the neighborhood, feeding on the living matter of his son. The father was cracking his skin, changing his gaze, exploding out of his body. And in fact, look at him. He tore the nightgown off her chest, bared her breasts, clasped her fiercely, leaned over to bite her nipples. And when she, as she had always been able to do, repressed her horror and tried to tear him off her by pulling his hair, groping with her mouth as she sought to bite him until he bled, he drew back, seized her arms, pinned them under his huge bent legs, said to her contemptuously, "What are you doing? Be quiet. You're just a twig. If I want to break you, I'll break you." But Leela wouldn't calm down. She bit the air. She arched to get his weight off of her. In vain. He now had his hands free, and leaning over her, he slapped her lightly with the tips of his fingers, and kept telling her, pressing her, "See how big it is? Say yes. Say yes. Say yes." Until he took out of his pajamas his stubby sex that, extended over her, seemed like a puppet without arms or legs, congested by mute stirrings, in a frenzy to uproot itself from that other, bigger puppet that was saying hoarsely, "Now I'll make you feel it, Leela. Look how nice it is. Nobody's got one like this." And since she was still writhing, he hit her twice, first with the palm of his hand, then with the back, and so hard that she understood that if she continued to resist, he would certainly kill her, or at least Don Achille would, who frightened the neighborhood because you knew that with his strength he could hurl you against a wall or a tree. And she emptied herself of all rebellion, yielding to a soundless terror, while he drew back, pulled up her nightgown, whispered in her ear, "You don't realize how much I love you, but you will know, and tomorrow it will be you asking me to love you as I am now, and more. In fact, you will go down on your knees and beg me, and I will say, 'Yes, but only if you are obedient,' and you will be obedient." When, after some awkward attempts, he tore her flesh with passionate brutality, Leela was absent. The night, the room, the bed, his kisses, his hands on her body. Every sensation was absorbed by a single feeling. She hated Stefano Caracci. She hated his strength. She hated his weight on her. She hated his name and his surname.
8. They returned to the neighborhood 4 days later. That same evening, Stefano invited his parents-in-law and his brother-in-law to the new house. With a humbler expression than usual, he asked Fernando to tell Lila what had happened with Silvio Solara. Fernando confirmed to his daughter, in unhappy, disjointed sentences, Stefano's version. As for Rino, Carracci asked him right afterward to tell why, in the end, they had made the mutual but painful decision to give Marcello the shoes he insisted on. Rino, in the manner of a man who knows what's what, declared pompously, "There are situations in which certain choices are obligatory." Then he started in with the serious trouble Pasquale, Antonio, and Enzo had got into when they beat up the Solara brothers and wrecked their car. "You know who was more at risk?" he said, leaning toward his sister and raising his voice. "Them, your friends, those knights in shining armor. Marcello recognized them and was convinced that you had sent them. Stefano and I, what were we supposed to do? You wanted those three idiots to get a beating a lot worse than the one they gave? You wanted to ruin them? And for what, anyway? For a pair of size 43 shoes that your husband can't wear because they're too narrow for him? And when it rains, the water gets in? We made peace. And since those shoes were so important to Marcello, we gave them to him."
Words. With them, you can do and undo as you please. Lila had always been good with words. But on that occasion, contrary to expectations, she didn't open her mouth. Relieved, Rino reminded her spitefully that it was she who, ever since she was a child, had been harassing him, telling him they had to get rich. "Then," she said, laughing, "make us rich without complicating our life, which is already too complicated." At that point, a surprise for the mistress of the house, though certainly not for the others, the doorbell rang, and Pinuccia, Alfonso, and their mother Maria appeared with a tray of pastries freshly made by Spagnuolo himself, the Solara's pastry maker. At first, it seemed that they had come to celebrate the newlyweds' return from their honeymoon, since Stefano passed around the wedding pictures, which he had just picked up from the photographer. For the movie, he explained, it would take a little longer. But it soon became clear that the wedding of Stefano and Lila was already old news. The pastries were intended to mark a new happy event, the engagement of Rino and Pinuccia. All the tension was set aside. Rino replaced the violent tones of a few minutes earlier with tender modulations and dialect, exaggerated pronouncements of love, the wonderful idea of having the engagement party right away, in his sister's lovely house. Then, with a theatrical gesture, he took a package out of his pocket. The package, when it was unwrapped, revealed a dark, rounded case, and the case, when it was opened, revealed a diamond ring. Lila noted that it wasn't that different from the one she wore on her finger next to the wedding ring, and wondered where her brother had got the money. There were hugs and kisses. There was a lot of talk of the future, speculation about who would manage the Cerullo shoe store in Piazza dei Martiri when the Solaras opened it in the fall. Rino supposed that Pinuccia would manage it, maybe by herself, maybe with Giliola Spagnuolo, who was officially engaged to Michele and so was making claims. The family reunion became livelier and full of hope. Lila remained standing most of the time. It hurt to sit down. No one, not even her mother, who who was silent during the entire visit, seemed to notice her swollen black right eye, the cut on her lower lip, the bruises on her arms. 9. She was still in that state when, there on the stairs that led to the house of her mother-in-law, I took off her glasses, unwound her scarf. The skin around her eye had a yellowish color, and her lower lip was a purple stain with fiery red stripes. To her friends and relatives, she said that she had fallen on the rocks in Amalfi on a beautiful sunny morning, when she and her husband had taken a boat to a beach just at the foot of a yellow wall. During the engagement lunch for her brother and Pinucha, she had used, in telling that lie, a sarcastic tone, and they had all sarcastically believed her, especially the women, who knew what had to be said when the men who loved them and whom they loved beat them severely. Besides, there was no one in the neighborhood, especially of the female sex, who did not think that she had needed a good thrashing for a long time. So the beatings did not cause outrage, and in fact, sympathy and respect for Stefano increased. There was someone who knew how to be a man. But when I saw her so battered, my heart leaped to my throat. I embraced her. And when she said she hadn't come to visit because she didn't want me to see her in that state, tears came to my eyes. The story of her honeymoon, as the photo novels put it, although stripped down, almost cold, made me angry, pained me. And yet, I have to admit, I also felt a tenuous pleasure. I was content to discover that Leela now needed help, maybe protection. And that admission of fragility, not toward the neighborhood, but toward me, moved me. I felt that the distances had unexpectedly gotten shorter again, and I was tempted to tell her right away that I had decided to quit school, that school was useless, that I didn't have the right qualities. It seemed to me that the news would comfort her. But her mother-in-law looked out over the banister on the top floor and called her. Leela ended her story with a few hurried sentences. She said that Stefano had tricked her, that he was just like his father. "You remember that Don Achille gave us money instead of the dolls?" she asked. "Yes. We shouldn't have taken it. We bought Little Women. We were wrong. Ever since that moment, I've been wrong about everything." She wasn't upset. She was sad. She put her dark glasses back on. She re-knotted the scarf. I was pleased about that "we." We shouldn't have taken it. We were wrong. But the abrupt transition to the "I" annoyed me. I have been wrong about everything. "We," I would have liked to correct her. Always "we." But I didn't. It seemed to me that she was trying to comprehend her new condition, and that she urgently needed to know what she could hold on to in order to confront it. Before starting up the flight of stairs, she asked, "Would you like to come and study at my house?" "When?" "This afternoon? Tomorrow? Every day?" "Stefano will be annoyed." "If he is the master, I am the master's wife." "I don't know, Leela. I'll give you a room. I'll shut you in." "What's the point?" She shrugged. "To know that you're there." I didn't say yes or no. I went off and wandered through the city as usual. Leela was sure that I would never quit school. She had assigned me the role of the friend with glasses and pimples, always bent over her books, smart in school,
and she couldn't even imagine that I might change. But I didn't want that role anymore. It seemed to me that, thanks to the humiliation of the unpublished article, I had thoroughly understood my inadequacy. Even though Nino was born and had grown up like Leela and me in that wretched outlying neighborhood, he was able to use school with intelligence. I was not. So stop deluding myself. Stop striving. Accept your lot, as Carmela, Ada, Giliola, and, in her way, Leela herself have long since done. I didn't go to her house that afternoon or the following ones, and I continued to skip school, tormenting myself. One morning, I went wandering not far from the school, along Via Veterinaria, behind the Botanic Garden. I thought of the conversations I had had recently with Antonio. He was hoping to avoid military service. As the son of a widowed mother and the sole support of the family, he wanted to ask for a raise in the shop, and also save so that he could take over the management of a gas pump along the Stradone. We would get married. I would help out at the pump. The choice of a simple life. My mother would approve. I can't always please Leela, I said to myself. But how hard it was to erase from my mind the ambitions inspired by school. At the time when classes were over, I went, almost without intending it, to the neighborhood of the school, and walked around there. I was afraid of being seen by the teachers, and yet, I realized, I wished them to see me. I wanted to be either branded irremediably as a no longer model student, or recaptured by the rhythms of school and submit to the obligation to go back. The first groups of students appeared. I heard someone calling me. It was Alfonso. He was waiting for Marisa, but she was late. Are you going together? I asked, teasing. No. She's the one who's got a crush.
Liar.
You're the liar, telling me you were sick, and look at you. You're fine. Professor Galliani is always asking about you. I told her you had a bad fever.
I did, in fact.
Obviously.
He was carrying his books, tied up with elastic under his arm. His face was strained by the tension of the hours of school.
Did Alfonso also conceal Don Achille, his father, in his breast, despite his delicate appearance? Is it possible that our parents never die, that every child inevitably conceals them in himself? Would my mother truly emerge from me, with her limping gait, as my destiny?
I asked him, "Did you see what your brother did to Leena?" Alfonso was embarrassed.
Yes.
And you didn't say anything to him?
You have to see what Leena did to him.
Would you be able to act the same way with Marisa? He laughed timidly.
No.
You sure?
Yes.
Why?
Because I know you. Because we talk. Because we go to school together.
At the moment, I didn't understand. What did I know you mean? What did we talk and we go to school together mean? I saw Marisa at the end of the street. She was running because she was late. Your girlfriend's coming, I said. He didn't turn. He shrugged. He mumbled,
"Come back to school, please."
I'm sick, I repeated, and left. I didn't want to exchange even a hello with Nino's sister. Any sign that evoked him made me anxious. But Alfonso's obscure words did me good. I turned them over in my mind as I walked. He had said that because he knew me, We talked to each other. We sat at the same desk. He would never impose his authority on a possible wife by beating her. He had expressed himself with a frank sincerity. He wasn't afraid of attributing to me, even if in a confused way, the capacity to influence him, a male, to change his behavior. I was grateful to him for that tangled message, which consoled me and set in motion a reconciliation between me and myself. It doesn't take much for a conviction that has become fragile to weaken to the point of giving way. The next day, I forged my mother's signature and returned to school. That evening, at the ponds, clinging to Antonio to escape the cold, I promised him, "I'll finish the school year and we'll get married." 10. But I had a hard time making up the ground I had lost, especially in science, and I tried to reduce my meetings with Antonio so that I could concentrate on my books. When I missed a date because I had to study, he became gloomy. He asked me, in alarm, "Is something wrong?" "I've got a lot of homework." "How is it that all of a sudden you've got more homework?" "I've always had a lot." "Before you didn't have any." "It was a coincidence." "What are you hiding from me, Lenu?" "Nothing. Do you still love me?" I reassured him, but meanwhile the time moved quickly by us, and I went home angry at myself because I still had so much studying to do. Antonio's fixation was always the same, Sadatore's son. He was afraid that I would talk to him, even that I would see him. Naturally, to prevent him from suffering, I concealed the fact that I ran into Nino entering school, coming out, in the corridors. Nothing particular happened. At most, we exchanged a nod of greeting and went on our way. I could have talked to my boyfriend about it without any problems, if he had been a reasonable person. But Antonio was not reasonable, and in truth, I wasn't either. Although Nino gave me no encouragement, a mere glimpse of him left me distracted during class. His presence a few classrooms away, real, alive, better educated than the professors, and courageous, and disobedient, drained meaning from the teacher's lectures, the pages of the books, the plans for marriage, the gas pump on the Stradone. Even at home, I couldn't study. Added to my confusing thoughts about Antonio, about Nino, about the future of my mother's irritability as she yelled at me to do this or that, and my siblings, who came one by one to have me look at their homework. That permanent turmoil wasn't new. I had always studied in disorder. But the old determination that had allowed me to do my best, even in those conditions, seemed to be used up. I couldn't or didn't want to reconcile school with everyone's needs anymore. So I would let the afternoon go by helping my mother, correcting my sister's and brother's exercises, and studying little or not at all for myself. And if once I had sacrificed sleep to books, now, since I was still exhausted and sleep seemed to me a respite, at night I forgot about homework and went to bed. And so I began to show up in class not only inattentive, but unprepared. And I lived in fear that the teachers would call on me, which soon happened. Once, in the same day, I got low marks in chemistry, art history, and philosophy. And my nerves were so frayed that right after the last bad grade, I burst into tears in front of everyone. It was a terrible moment. I felt the horror and the pleasure of losing myself, the fear and the pride in going off the rails. As we were leaving school, Alfonso told me that his sister-in-law had asked him to tell me to go and see her. "Go on," he urged me anxiously.
Surely you'll study better there than at your house.
So that afternoon, I made up my mind and walked to the new neighborhood. But I didn't go to Leela's house to find a solution to my problems with school. I took it for granted that we would talk the whole time, and that my situation as a former model student would get even worse. I said to myself, rather, better to go off the rails talking to Leela than in the midst of my mother's yelling, the petulant demands of my siblings, the yearnings for Nino, Antonio's recriminations. At least I would learn something about married life, a life that soon, I now assumed, would be mine. Leela greeted me with obvious pleasure. Her eye was no longer swollen. Her lip was healing. She was nicely dressed. Her hair was carefully combed. She wore lipstick. Yet she moved through the apartment as if her house were alien to her, and she herself felt like a visitor. The wedding presents were still piled up near the door. The rooms had a smell of plaster and fresh paint, mixed with the vaguely alcoholic scent that emanated from the new furniture in the dining room. The table, the sideboard with a mirror framed by dark wood foliage, the silver chest full of silver, the plates, glasses, and bottles of colored liquors. Leela made coffee. It was pleasant to sit with her in the spacious kitchen and play at being ladies, as we had done as children in front of the cellar air vent. It's relaxing, I thought. I was wrong not to come sooner. I had a friend of my age with her own house, full of opulent, orderly things. That friend, who had nothing to do all day, seemed happy for my company. Although we had changed, and the changes were still occurring, the warmth between us endured intact. Why then not give in to it? For the first time since her wedding day, I felt at ease. "How's it going with Stefano?" I asked. "Fine. You've cleared things up?" She smiled in amusement. "Yes, it's all clear." "And so?"
"Disgusting."
"The same as Amalfi?"
"Yes."
"Did he beat you again?"
She touched her face. "No, this is old stuff."
"Then?"
"It's the humiliation."
"And you?"
"I do what he wants." I thought for a moment. I asked her suggestively,
"But at least when you sleep together, isn't it nice?"
She made a grimace of discomfort, became serious. She began to speak of her husband with a sort of loathing acceptance. It wasn't hostility. It wasn't a need for retaliation. It wasn't even disgust. But a placid disdain, a contempt that invested Stefano's entire person like polluted water in the ground. I listened. I understood, and I didn't understand. Long ago, she had threatened Marcello with the shoemaker's knife simply because he had dared to grab my wrist and break the bracelet. From that point on, I was sure that if Marcello had just brushed against her, she would have killed him. But toward Stefano, now she showed no explicit aggression. Of course, the explanation was simple. We had seen our fathers beat our mothers from childhood. We had grown up thinking that a stranger must not even touch us, but that our father, our boyfriend, and our husband could hit us when they liked, out of love, to educate us, to re-educate us. As a result, since Stefano was not the hateful Marcello, but the young man to whom she had declared her love, whom she had married, and with whom she had decided to live forever, she assumed complete responsibility for her choice. And yet it didn't add up. In my eyes, Leela was Leela, not an ordinary girl of the neighborhood. Our mothers, after they were slapped by their husbands, did not have that expression of calm disdain. They despaired. They wept.
They confronted their man sullenly. They criticized him behind his back. And yet, more and less, they continued to respect him. My mother, for example, plainly admired my father's devious deals. Leela instead displayed an acquiescence without respect. I said, I feel comfortable with Antonio, even though I don't love him. And I hoped that, in accord with our old habits, she would be able to grasp in that statement a series of hidden questions. Although I love Nino, I was saying without saying it, I feel pleasantly excited just thinking of Antonio, of our kisses, of holding and touching each other at the ponds. Love, in my case, is not indispensable to pleasure, nor is respect. Is it possible, therefore, that the disgust, the humiliation, begin afterward? When a man subdues you and violates you at his pleasure, solely because you now belong to him, love or not, respect or not? What happens when you're in a bed, crushed by a man? She had experienced that, and I would have liked her to talk about it. Instead, she confined herself to saying, sarcastically, better for you if you're comfortable, and she led me to a small room that looked out onto the railroad tracks. It was a bare space. There was only a desk, a chair, a cot, nothing on the walls. Do you like it here?
Yes.
Then study. She left, closing the door behind her. The room smelled of damp plaster more than the rest of the house. I looked out the window. I would have preferred to go on talking. But it was immediately clear to me that Alfonso had told her about my absence from school, maybe even about my bad grades, and that she wanted to restore to me the wisdom she had always attributed to me, even at the cost of imposing it on me. Better that way. I heard her moving through the house, making a phone call. It struck me that she didn't say, "Hello, it's Lena," or, I don't know, "It's Lena Cerullo," but, "Hello, this is Signora Caracci." I sat down at the desk, opened my history book, and forced myself to study. 11. The close of the school year was inauspicious. The building that housed the high school was crumbling. Rain leaked into the classrooms. After one violent storm, a street nearby caved in. There followed a period when we went to school on alternate days. Homework began to count more than the normal lessons. The teachers loaded it on to the point where it was unbearable. Despite my mother's protests, I got in the habit of going to Leela's right after school. I arrived at 2 in the afternoon. I dropped my book somewhere. She made me a sandwich with prosciutto, cheese, salami, anything I wanted. Such abundance was never seen at my parents' house. How good the smell of fresh bread was, and the taste of the fillings, especially the prosciutto, bright red, edged with white. I ate greedily, and Leela made me coffee. After we'd had some intense conversation, she closed me in the little room and seldom looked in, except to bring me a snack and to eat or drink with me. Since I had no wish to run into Stefano, who generally returned from the grocery around 8 at night, I always left right at 7. I became familiar with the apartment, with its light, with the sounds that came from the railroad. Every space, everything was new and clean, but especially the bathroom, which had a sink, a bidet, a bathtub. One afternoon, when I felt particularly lazy, I asked Leela if I could have a bath, I, who still washed under the tap or in a copper tub. She said I could do what I wanted and went to bring me towels. The water came out hot from the tap, and I let it run. I undressed. I sank in up to my neck. That warmth was an unexpected pleasure. After a while, I tried out the numerous little bottles that crowded the corners of the tub. A steamy foam arose, as if from my body, and almost overflowed. Ah, how many wonderful things Leela possessed. It was no longer just a matter of a clean body. It was play. It was abandon. I discovered the lipsticks, the makeup, the wide mirror that reflected an image without deformities, the hairdryer. Afterward, my skin was smoother than I had ever felt it, and my hair was full, luminous, blonder. Maybe the wealth we wanted as children is this, I thought. Not strong boxes full of diamonds and gold coins, but a bathtub. To immerse yourself like this every day. To eat bread, salami, prosciutto. To have a lot of space even in the bathroom. To have a telephone. A pantry and icebox full of food. A photograph in a silver frame on the sideboard that shows you in your wedding dress. To have this entire house with the kitchen, the bedroom, the dining room, the two balconies, and the little room where I am studying. And where, even though Leela hasn't said so, soon, when it comes, a baby will sleep. That evening I hurried to the ponds. I couldn't wait for Antonio to caress me, smell me, marvel, enjoy that luxurious cleanliness that highlighted beauty. It was a gift that I wanted to give him, but he had his anxieties. He said, "I'll never be able to offer you these things." And I answered, "Who says that I want them?" And he replied, "You always want to do what Leela does." I was offended. We quarreled. I was independent. I did only what I liked. I did what he and Leela didn't and couldn't do. I went to school. I studied hard, was going blind over my books. I cried that he didn't understand me, that all he did was disparage and insult me, and I ran away. But Antonio understood me too well. Day by day, my friend's house charmed me more. It became a magical place where I could have everything. Far from the wretched gray of the old buildings where we had grown up, the flaking walls, the scratched doors, the same objects always, dented and chipped. Leela was careful not to disturb me. I would call out, "I'm thirsty. I'm kind of hungry. Let's turn on the television. Can I see this? Can I see that?" I was bored by studying. I struggled. Sometimes I asked her to listen to me while I repeated the lessons aloud. She sat on the cot, I at the desk. I showed her the pages I had to repeat. I recited. Leela checked me line for line. It was on those occasions that I realized how her relationship with books had changed. Now she was intimidated by them. She no longer wanted to impose on me an order, her own rhythm, as if just a few sentences were enough to get a picture of the whole and master it so that she could tell me, "This is the important concept. Start here." When, following me in the textbook, she had the impression that I was mistaken, she corrected me with 1,000 apologies, such as, "Maybe I didn't understand it. Maybe you should check." She seemed not to realize that her capacity to learn effortlessly remained intact. But I knew. I saw, for example, that chemistry, so boring for me, provoked in her that narrow look, and her few observations awakened me from my apathy, excited me. I saw that after half a page of the philosophy textbook, she was able to find surprising connections between Anaxagoras, the order that the intellect imposes on the chaos of things, and Mendeleev's tables. But more often, I had the impression that she was aware of the inadequacy of her tools, of the naivete of her observations, and she restrained herself on purpose. As soon as she realized that she had let herself get too involved, she retreated as if before a trap and mumbled, "Lucky you who understand. I don't know what you're talking about." Once, she closed the book abruptly and said with annoyance, "That's enough." "Why?" "Because I've had it. It's always the same story. Inside something small, there's something even smaller that wants to leap out. And outside something large, there's always something larger that wants to keep it a prisoner. I'm going to cook." And yet I wasn't studying anything that had to do in an obvious way with the small and the large. Her own capacity to learn had irritated her, or perhaps frightened her, and she had retreated. Where? To make dinner. To clean the house. To watch television with the volume low in order not to disturb me. To look at the tracks, the train traffic, the fleeting outline of Vesuvius. The streets of the new neighborhood, still without trees and without shops. The rare car traffic. The women with their shopping bags, small children attached to their skirts. Occasionally, and only on Stefano's orders, or because he asked her to go with him, she went out to the place. It was less than 500 meters from the house, once I went with her, where the new grocery was to be built. There, she took measurements with a carpenter's measuring tape to plan shelves and furnishings. That was it. She had nothing else to do. I soon realized that, being married, she was more alone than before. I sometimes went out with Carmela, with Ada, even with Giliola. And at school, I had made friends with girls in my class and other classes, so that sometimes I met them for ice cream on Via Furia. But she saw only Pinuccia, her sister-in-law. As for the boys, if during the period of her engagement they still stopped to exchange a few words, now, after her marriage, they gave a nod of greeting at most when they met on the street. And yet she was beautiful, and she dressed like the pictures in the women's magazines that she bought in great numbers. But the condition of wife had enclosed her in a sort of glass container, like a sailboat sailing with sails unfurled in an inaccessible place without the sea. Pasquale, Enzo, Antonio himself would never have ventured onto the unshaded white streets of newly built houses, to her doorway, to her apartment, to talk a little or invite her to take a walk. And even the telephone, a black object attached to the kitchen wall, seemed a useless ornament. The whole time I studied at her house, it seldom rang, and when it did, it was usually Stefano, who had put one in the grocery as well, to take orders from customers. Their conversations as newlyweds were brief. She answered listlessly, "Yes. No." She used the telephone mainly for making purchases. In that period, she hardly ever went out of the house, as she waited for the signs of the beating to completely disappear from her face. But she bought things just the same. For example, after my joyous bath, after my enthusiasm about the way my hair had turned out, I heard her order a new hair dryer, and when it was delivered, she wanted to give it to me. She uttered that sort of magic formula, "Hello, this is Signora Caracci." And then she negotiated, discussed, gave up, bought. She didn't pay. The shopkeepers were all from the neighborhood. They knew Stefano well. She merely signed Lina Caracci, name and last name, as Maestra Oliviero had taught us. And she wrote the signature as if it were an assignment, with an intent half-smile, never even checking the merchandise, as if those marks on paper mattered more to her than the objects that were being delivered. She also bought some big albums with green covers decorated with floral motifs, in which she arranged the wedding photographs. She had printed just for me copies of, I don't know how many of them, all the ones in which I, my parents, my sister and brothers, even Antonio appeared. She telephoned and ordered the photographs. I found one in which Nino could be seen. There was Alfonso. There was Marisa. And he was at the right, cut off by the edge of the frame. Only his hair, his nose, his mouth. "Can I have this one, too?" I asked, without much enthusiasm. "You're not in it. I'm here, from the back." "All right. If you want it, I'll have it printed for you." I abruptly changed my mind. "No, forget it."
"Really? Go ahead."
"No." But the acquisition that most impressed me was the projector. The movie of the wedding had finally been developed. The photographer came one night to show it to the newlyweds and their relatives. Leila found out how much the machine cost. She had one delivered to her house and invited me to watch the film. She put the projector on the dining room table, took a painting of a stormy sea off the wall, expertly inserted the film, lowered the blinds, and the images began to flow over the white wall. It was a marvel. The movie was in color, just a few minutes long. I was astonished. Again, I saw her enter the church on Fernando's arm, come out into the church square with Stefano, their happy walk through the Parco delle Rimembranze, ending with a long kiss, the entrance into the restaurant, the dance that followed, the relatives eating or dancing, the cutting of the cake, the handing out of the favors, the goodbyes addressed to the lens. Stefano happy, she grim, both in their traveling clothes. The first time I saw it, I was struck most of all by myself. I appeared twice, first in the church square beside Antonio. I looked awkward, nervous, my face taken up by my glasses. The second time, I was sitting at the table with Nino and was barely recognizable. I was laughing, hands and arms moved with casual elegance. I adjusted my hair, toyed with my mother's bracelet. I seemed to myself refined and beautiful. Leila, in fact, exclaimed, "Look how well you came out." "Not really," I lied. "You look the way you do when you're happy." The second time we watched, I said to her, "Play it again." She didn't have to be asked twice. What struck me instead was the Solara's entrance into the restaurant. The cameraman had caught the moment that had registered most profoundly in me. The moment Nino left the room and Marcello and Michele burst in. The two brothers entered side by side in their dress clothes. They were tall and muscular, thanks to the time they spent in the gym lifting weights. Meanwhile, Nino, slipping out, head lowered, just bumped Marcello's arm. And as Marcello abruptly turned, with a mean, bullying look, he vanished, indifferent, without looking back. The contrast seemed violent. It wasn't so much the poverty of Nino's clothes, which clashed with the opulence of the Solaras, with the gold they wore on their necks and their wrists and their fingers. It wasn't even his extreme thinness, which was accentuated by his height. He was at least 3 inches taller than the brothers, who were tall too, and which suggested a fragility opposed to the virile strength that Marcello and Michele displayed with smug satisfaction. Rather, it was the indifference. While the Solara's arrogance could be considered normal, the haughty carelessness with which Nino had bumped into Marcello and kept going was not at all normal. Even those who detested the Solaras,
like Pasquale, Enzo, or Antonio, had, one way or another, to reckon with them. Nino, on the other hand, not only didn't apologize, but didn't so much as glance at Marcello. The scene provided